This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Today we are in Cambrai.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I am with, just for a change, Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Daniel Freeb.
Hello, hello.
Where are we, Lionel?
Well, we're in Cambrai, in northern France, finally in France. I don't know what this building is. Is this an indoor...
Mediatek.
Which is a...
Really know, it's one of those French concepts that we don't really, it's a bit like Son et Lumière, you know, sound, you know, Son et Lumière, that's for people who've never seen electricity before, in action.
Well, that's where we are, but more importantly, we are at the finish, in the finish town of the stage four, which was over the cobbles, much anticipated. Did it live up to the anticipation, Daniel?
It did, in the sense that the racing was fantastic. There was a headwind, which made attacking difficult. It made splitting the group difficult. But we saw a fantastic exhibition of bicycling by some of the leading general classification contenders, particularly Vincenzo Nibali, who was just velvety, wasn't he?
Great bicycling by Vincenzo Nibali, velvety.
People will think that Ned Bolting's making a cameo on the podcast. No, Nibali was just fantastic, an absolute maestro on the cobbles, isn't he? And, you know, last year, after a similar performance, he laughed off suggestions that he should maybe think about having a go at Paris-Roubaix. You know, when you think of what Bradley Wiggins did, training in a different way, putting on some weight and really targeting Paris-Roubaix, and you look at Nibali's natural aptitude, if he was to want to shift his focus to something else in the future, I'm sure he'd be capable of having a good go at Paris-Roubaix. So he was massively impressive, as was Chris Froome, we have to say. Froome didn't look certainly not as easy on the eye, was he?
When is he ever?
Whizzy was how our friend from Velo News, Kaylee Fretz, I think, described his pedalling action, and it was, and it looked very erratic at times, but he managed to stay upright, and you know, he's obviously so strong at the moment.
A really professional podcast would edit the next bit into the start of the show, because I completely forgot about your little roundup, Lionel, but we'll just do it now. Let's do it now.
Yeah. It's just to help the listeners so they know what they're, you know, where we are, what we're talking about in this.
All right. No need to justify it. I mean, I've given you your opportunity
get
now.
Get back in your kennel, Lionel. Get back in.
I've been out. You've let me out for the day onto the cobbles, and now I'm just being put back in my box. Is that right? Yeah.
Come on, Lionel. On with it.
Okay, well, finally, the Tour de France reached France on its fourth day, and finally, Tony Martin took the yellow jersey. He's been kind of creeping up on it as if he'd been playing a German game of grandmother's footsteps. He was five seconds back on Saturday, 3 seconds back on Sunday, 1 second back on Monday, and finally he is in the yellow jersey. You know grandmother's footsteps.
I've never heard of it. I'm not familiar with that at all.
It's where one person... I'm not explaining the rules of grandmother's footsteps. If you look it up on the internet...
I know chess. That's a game that you've mentioned before. Can you just stick to chess, please?
Well, basically, you sneak up on the one person who's at the front of the room, and when they turn around and look at you, anyone who's still moving is out of the game. A bit like, kind of, you know, pass the parcel or musical chairs. Anyway, yeah, a good day for TJ Van Garderen, a good day for Warren Barguil, a good day for Rigoberto Urán. I should say Barguil, a good day in terms of his result, perhaps not in terms of his teamwork. I'm sure you guys will talk about that in a bit. But another bad day for Thibaut Pinot, lost another 3 minutes 23. The big four GC, which I know everyone is very keen to know about, that's unchanged from yesterday. The four big cheeses are in exactly the same order and exactly the same time gaps, so the cobbles didn't change anything.
I don't think we'd have predicted that, would we? I guess last year with the rain, the cobbles had drama and carnage. This year we kind of just had the drama. It was dramatic. Nibali's accelerations on the cobbles were something to behold. He really strung the race out. He looked the strongest guy on the cobbles, the most accomplished. I think the headwind probably played against any kind of split forming. Froome desperately sort of working his way back up to Nibali on several occasions. Quintana just sitting there at the back of the group, hanging on at the back of the group, and it was amazing really to see this little Colombian sitting there finishing with the leaders, an outstanding win. And you know, Nibali laid the foundations for his overall victory last year on the cobble stage. Maybe Quintana's done that today, who knows.
Yeah, Lionel mentioned the tour coming back to France. One thing that struck me today, I really missed the sort of ambient mood of ennui, complacency and apathy that the French bring to their national sporting showcase, don't you? I mean, there really is a sense of they don't really care, and it comes every year and it will come again to our village in 5 years, and yeah, it's great, we'll wave a few flags, but let's not get too excited about it.
Whatevs is a general, that sums up the generality. Anyway. What's French for whatevs?
Anyway, back to the race. You mentioned Nibali, how silky he was, how agile he was.
You mentioned that, Daniel.
I mentioned that. Well, I was chatting at the finish line to his coach, Paolo Slongo, and we were discussing this, you know, and it really is God-given. It is the same. It's the same skill that really enables him to go downhill so quickly, and he just has such a relaxed attitude to, well, to everything really, but
on bicycling.
Yeah, on his bike he looks so relaxed. And there was a particular moment where I think Tony Galopin forced him onto a grass verge, and not a flat grass verge either. It was a sort of a little into a gully and then up a hill almost, and he just took one hand off the bars, gently eased Galopin out the way, rode halfway up the bank and back onto the cobbles again.
He actually had a cornetto in sector 5. I don't know if anybody noticed that. There was one moment as well where Froome was forced off the road and, you know, had to sort of bunny hop back on and then almost collided with a thinking AG Tour rider. Yeah, in that moment his tour could have been over. There'll be a lot of very relieved riders tonight, I think. Lionel was out doing his cobbled thing today, an annual cobbled thing. Daniel and I were at the finish line, and we watched the finish on the screen helpfully erected outside the Movistar team bus, and watched the race, watched Tony Martin's attack, and then went strolled towards the finish, and John Degenkolb emerged, you know, from the finish line, and as he came towards us, his director had his arm around him, and Degenkolb was lifting the front wheel, you know, sort of lifting up, crashing it back down, and yelling, sort of primal sort of scream was coming from John Denkel. He was fuming, he was angry, he was second on the stage, but this was one, and we'll hear from his director sportif Mark Reef in a moment or so, but this was one he targeted, this one he felt he could win. Now, you spoke to Warren Barguil at the finish, Daniel, and he seemed to be the only teammate that Denkel had left in that leading group, not the teammate he probably would have chosen, not somebody who's used to being in that situation. He's a climber, riding his first Tour de France. But what were your impressions of Barguil?
Well, Barguil rode a fantastic race in terms of his own ambitions, and he's coming to this Tour de France. Obviously, it's his first Tour de France. A lot of hype surrounding him. He's ridden two fantastic Vueltas in Spain, and he's really impressed this week, hasn't he? And really impressed on the cobbles. Never raced before on the cobbles. He'd been fairly impressive when they went to Recce, the course, in the spring. Nonetheless, we were pretty surprised to see him at the front on the last couple of sectors. And I suppose, you know, they have to cut him some slack. He's not riding, well, purportedly not riding for GC. He's riding mainly to win stages and climb well in the Alps and the Pyrenees. But he does find himself very high GC. However, you know, Degenkolb obviously wanted him to go to the front and chase down Martin when Tony Martin attacked at 3 kilometres to go. I think Barguil was probably a bit disoriented at that point, couldn't quite believe where he was himself and hesitated for a second. And it was pretty clear at the Giant Alpecin bus at the finish that Warren Barguil was... Well, he was looking nervously in the direction of John Degenkolb, and as I think I wrote on Twitter, there was steam rising from the top of John Degenkolb's head. And Barguil almost sounded like he was about to break down in tears, in fact. I don't know whether that was just because it'd been a very stressful day and his nerves were frayed slightly, but I think he felt very, very sorry and contrite about not having been able to help Degenkolb to a stage victory.
Well, that'll maybe have taken a bit of the gloss off what, as you say, was otherwise a terrific ride, and he's had a terrific first few days of the tour. I spoke at the finish to Mark Reef, the director sportif of the Giant Alpecin team, about Degenkolb and Warren Barguil. John Degenkolb seemed rather frustrated at the finish there, a chance that went away from him today.
Frustrated, maybe, but more disappointed, I think. He was really disappointed. We had a goal here today. This was one of the highlights for him during the Tour de France, and that you then, I don't know how many times he got second already, but that's the problem. There's every time one guy just a little bit in front, or just who's beating him.
He'll have other chances this week, though, you would think, with some of the other finishes that are coming up. Is he looking at some of those stages as well?
Yeah, of course, but this was the first goal, and that you are that close after such a stage and become second, and that's just a big disappointment.
So that was a negative point for Giant Alpecin today, but Warren Barguil, obviously a fantastic ride by him, and he's been riding extremely well these first few days of the Tour. You must be very happy about where he is at the moment.
Yes, of course. I mean, he's a skinny guy. He's a small guy, and that he still can make it every time again.
Did that surprise you to see himself in that group?
He can handle couples pretty well, but I was surprised that he was still there. I mean, there are 40 riders left over with the big guys, and that he was still there was for me a little bit surprised. Yeah.
Is it because he's in great form? I mean, when a rider like that is in great shape and great form, is that when they can perform like that on surfaces, conditions that don't necessarily suit them?
Yeah, he's also, it's the first Tour de France for him, and we don't have a goal in GC with him, so he's totally free, having no stress, having no pressure to do something, and I think that is something Sim also.
Is a mountain stage win the goal for him?
Yeah, that's.
And yet he is very well placed in GC now.
Still, but I mean, we still have 17 days to go. You saw yesterday how fast it can go with a crash, or like stage two with the wind, that someone in front of you cannot hold the wheel, and then it's over. So we just look day by day, and we will see what it is when we go into the mountains.
Follow us on Twitter @cycling_podcast or on our website, thecyclingpodcast.com. And now, Le Pédaleur de Charme, supported by British Eurosport.
So, chaps, there were lots of nominations for Pédaleur de Charme today. Lots and lots and lots. Lots for Geraint Thomas, Vincenzo Nibali, lots for Warren Barguil as well. But in the end, we have decided to give the British Eurosport Pédaleur de Charme award to Matteo Trentin, the Italian rider who was with Tony Martin when he punctured on the final section of cobbles and gave him his bike. A charming gesture, we thought, and the Pédaleur de Charme can encompass charming behaviour as well as charming pedalling.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, that's what it is, isn't it? It's charming behaviour, and it's a fluid.
Well, it's stylishness, I think. I think it's stylishness,
it's
really.
Not, I mean,
class.
Yeah, and I think we've had quite a lot of people, particularly yesterday because of the crashes, you know, lots of people nominating people who came down very hard in the crash. It's not really an award for a sort of, you know, a bad luck award or a heroic award. And it doesn't really feel terribly appropriate to sort of give an award.
I said this last night. We also want to make life a little bit easier for ourselves. Riders who have crashed heavily the day before and are facing up to 4, 5, 6 hours on a bike on pavé are generally not in that good a mood the next morning. That's been you just don't approach them. You certainly don't approach them with a t-shirt with Pédaleur de Charme written on it. I think that's going to be our policy. They're just not in the mood for that sort of caper. So anyway, Matteo Trentin,
especially not when we give them the bill for one, 1999.
I think they're only £19, actually, Daniel. I think they're, and they are available. All our T-shirts, I don't think we've mentioned this yet, but all our T-shirts with their various slogans on them, Where Are We Lionel and so on, are available at thecyclingpodcast.com in the shop. So go in there and buy your T-shirts. There's a Ciro Scogna Emilio tribute T-shirt there as well, I must confess. So, anyway, that leads us into talking about Tony Martin, who won the stage. Etics Quickstep, teammate of Matteo Trentin. Martin, quite surprising that when he jumped, nobody followed him. And he wondered at the end whether it was because it was known that he'd punctured, that he'd been on the limit to get back on. It was a surprise that he got back on, and that perhaps people underestimated his power, because there were still a lot of sprinters in the, you know, as Peter Sagan was there, and Tinkoff Saxo were pretty strong today as well. So, you know, it was a bit of a shocker, was it not, that they just let him go?
It was. The one thing I would say is that, okay, this is the Tour de France and everyone wants to win a stage, but Tony Martin's quite a popular guy in the peloton, and I think it wasn't only the media and it wasn't only the fans who had been sort of waiting with bated breath for him to take the yellow jersey and thinking that he deserved the yellow jersey and should have had it previously. There were maybe one or two people who could have pulled but didn't, chose not to. Rolf Aldag, the Etics Quickstep director, we'll hear from in a minute. I think he'll be particularly delighted that Tony Martin has won a stage going over cobbles, because since the start of Tony Martin's career, Rolf Aldag has maintained that Der Panzerwagen, as he is known, would make an excellent Paris-Roubaix rider.
Well, I asked him about that, and he said he's not really thinking about Paris-Roubaix at the moment. He's got to celebrate a victory here. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, he rode extremely well. And as you say, a popular winner. And he was asked how it would play back home in Germany, with German TV broadcasting the race live for the first time in a few years. They boycotted it after the doping scandals, but they've returned. And a popular win all round, I think, and a popular yellow jersey, Tony Martin.
I didn't actually see the finish because we'd been out on the penultimate section of cobbles at Kievi, the longest section, very popular with the photographers. They all headed to the same point on the left-hand right angle turn, which is sort of roughly halfway down that section of cobbles. But I saw on Twitter when we were driving back that Tony Martin had attacked and won, and I was glad about that. Having seen him at the top of the Mur de Huy yesterday, you know, he came over the line, came up to the Etics Quickstep bus, kind of hugged one of his teammates, got on the rollers, and was hit with the first question, which was, "It must be really frustrating for you not to have got the yellow jersey, having been so close." And it was like sort of his shoulders slumped another 6 inches as somebody put the obvious question to him. So it was really, you know, it was one of those things. And in terms of storytelling in the Tour, you know, it's good for the Tour de France that this kind of story is unfolded over 4 days. There was a mix-up with Mark Cavendish and the mini storm in a teacup over whether or not Cavendish should have carried on sprinting and could have taken a time bonus to put Martin into yellow a couple of days ago. So there's a nice unfolding story there. But just from my experience out on the cobbles, the second last section,
which will be a kilometre zero.
It will be a kilometre zero special, mixing with the fans and various other people out on the cobbles. That's our new weekday show, looking at another angle of the Tour de France. So that will be, I think, later on this week. But from being out there, it was a completely different race to the cobbles last year. And when I spoke to Rolf Aldag this morning, he was saying that last year's stage was a lot shorter, I think around about 165 kilometres, but the cobbles were much harder. This time the stage was longer, more of an endurance effort, more for the diesels at 223 kilometres, I think, but the cobbles themselves were not quite as severe. And obviously with the weather being more favourable, you know, it did spit with rain a bit and the cobbles did get a little bit wet, but generally for the riders it was dry, it was dusty, and there was a headwind as well for a lot of the crucial parts of the stage. And so I was quite surprised when they came past us with very little information to go on how big that group was of probably 40-45 riders at a time, and they were going some, but there was just obviously nothing to kind of break the elastic. And then it was a case of trying to pick out, you know, which riders had been distanced. But it wasn't as dramatic a spectacle out on the road this year as it was last. And of course, the implications last year were huge for the GC. This year, perhaps not so.
Well, I spoke to Rolf Aldag at the finish, the technical director, Etics Quickstep. What's his title, job title these days, Daniel?
Not sure.
Something.
He's basically in charge. He's in charge of the whole show, basically. That's if you speak to Mark Cavendish, that's what he will tell you.
I spoke to Rolf Aldag at the finish, the man in charge of the Etics Quickstep team. Always an interesting guy to speak to, Rolf Aldag. Spoke to him about Tony Martin's win, about the team in general. You've often spoken about Tony Martin as being a rider who would be capable of riding very well at Paris-Roubaix. He's ridden very well today on the cobbles. Do you think this might give him a taste for it?
He said it before. He already said it like this spring. He said, I might want to think about it. But to be honest, for now, it's just to think about the yellow jersey and to enjoy the moment and not to think about next April.
Is he? I mean, he's very upset the other day after just missing out. How has he been the last couple of days coping with that disappointment?
He's always bouncing back. You just cannot get him down. He's always there and he's always fighting back. You just can't get him down. And I think that's the Tony Martin that we've seen him crashing like in the Tour de France and nobody else would have continued. And he fights back and wins the time trial. And today, I mean, it was clear to say, well, we won't have so many more chances. And so we have to keep on trying. But like, that he didn't crack mentally in the last days was already amazing, because he had it so close and then we missed it out and we missed out and we missed out. And then what you also seen was a team commitment, because today five guys could have won that. And then you might have seen it, he wins on the bike of Trentin. He just steps off his bike and gives it to Tony. Then you show you see the team spirit there. That is like, okay, it's not about me, it's all about him. And we missed out three times now, and it's so close, and it's now or never. So everybody was willing to do everything. The other guys there, I think completely destroyed, like the chase there in the corners. Like Stieber sprinted to the inside, dragged everybody with him.
Are they identical size bikes, Trentin?
Not exactly, but they are both reverse. So they're both like similar. Left and right braking, because otherwise you couldn't even do it. You wouldn't get in one piece to the finish line. But then you see the commitment from the team. I mean, Cavendish was there. He probably could have won the sprint. But Tony said, I want to try. Obviously, Froome was not so keen on keeping the jersey, which is good for him. And then I think, yeah, Tony just went for it.
You are listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Fripp.
So we heard there from Rolf Aldag. Before we carry on with our analysis of the stage,
we also should give everyone a heads up about our live show on Wednesday evening. Wednesday night live at the Tour de France. It will be the three of us. We'll be taking questions from Twitter. We'll be reacting to the day's stage. And that will be going live at 6:30 UK time, so 7:30 French and Central European time, but 6:30 PM in the UK. And the way to listen to that, if you go to thecyclingpodcast.com and click on latest episodes, there is a page in there where you can access the live show. Perhaps the other best way is on mixlr.com, mixlr.com/thecyclingpodcast.
Now on with today's stage. Chris Froome, will he be happy to have lost the yellow jersey?
Yes, probably. It takes the heat off for a few days. Maybe they'll take it back in team time trial. Maybe even take it back at the Mur de Bretagne on Saturday, depending on how Tony Martin climbs. He probably shouldn't have too much difficulty there, I wouldn't have thought. 12 seconds, though, but with the time bonus on the line, you know, it's all up for grabs. But, you know, Froome's going to race the race. I wouldn't have thought having or not having the yellow jersey will necessarily be at the forefront of his mind, but just being rid of it for the next 2 to 3 days as they go up onto the coast, head up towards the northern coast, and that particularly that windy stage, they won't have quite the same onus to control a bunch for some difficult days.
We're expecting quite a straightforward day tomorrow, aren't we, to Amiens? I mean, could there be crosswinds tomorrow? It looks like a relatively, and maybe the first sort of straightforward stage.
At La Française des Jeux FDJ, they certainly expect crosswinds, and they expect the possibility of there being splits tomorrow, so they're very much on their guard.
Well, as Dave Brailsford says, you're almost you're most vulnerable after scoring a goal, and everybody's been building up to this stage, to the cobbled stage today, and it could be that, you know, there is an opportunity for somebody. Nibali obviously had a huge go today, didn't quite work out, but maybe I'll have another go tomorrow. At the finish, just spoke very briefly to Nicholas Roach, Chris Froome's teammate, who was pretty prominent in today's stage and has been playing an important role, a deeper role than normal. He goes a bit earlier than we've used to see him. When he rode at Tinkoff Saxo with Alberto Contador, he was often one of his last men in the mountains. I'm not sure that he's going to play that role here at the Tour. He seems to be being used up early, but Dave Brailsford has been pleased with him, and this was his verdict on today's stage at the finish.
We got him safe and sound into the cobble sections, and then G did an amazing job in the last bit. For me, as usual, is up there, you know, really focused. You know, the first one, even though there was 130k to go, I felt like we're going in for the last sector of the day. You know, everyone is still quite fresh. There's a lot of riders in the bunch, and everyone's going for it. It was really, really sketchy. Actually, as the race go by, then it's more on the, you know, your physical capabilities and how much riders you have around you and the team to get you into right position.
During the Tour de France, listen twice a day to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. There is all the latest interviews and analysis from every stage in the evening show. And in the morning, Monday to Friday, Kilometer Zero will take you inside the Tour in the company of the podcast team, Richard Moore, Daniel Fripp and Lionel Burney.
Finally, for a look at the cobble stage, Thibaut Pinot was the other talking point. He lost a couple more minutes today, as we mentioned earlier on.
3:23.
Oh, sorry, 3:23. A bit of a disaster. Now, what happened, Daniel? You think you went and spoke to him or his entourage at the finish?
Yeah, I mean, he struggled all day, as a lot of people feared that he might. He actually had problems yesterday after his teammate William Bonnet crashed out. Pinot was just behind him, and he got a very nasty fright. And I spoke to Mathieu Ladagnou, another FDJ rider at the finish, who said that Thibaut's legs yesterday were trembling. He was so frightened. He was so shaken up after the crash, after Bonnet's crash yesterday. So obviously he didn't go into today's stage in the best frame of mind. He struggled through the first three sections of cobbles, managed to get back onto the end of the front group, and then he had a mechanical problem. The problem was that the power shut off to his electronic derailleur. The battery was, I'm assured, to charge. One would hope so. But this is a problem that has affected various riders who used that particular gearing system or electronic gearing on rough terrain, on cobbles. Our good friend from Velo News, Kaylee Frett, suggested it was something to do with the wires coming loose. That's a possibility. But he's obviously very downcast now. He is, I think, 6.5 minutes down now, talking tonight about his general classification ambitions being over, having to refocus, come up with new objectives. Again, I know I keep banging on about this, but I think that would be premature to write himself off on general classification. I just had a quick look before the podcast tonight at the 1998 Tour de France. Marco Pantani at the foot of the Pyrenees. Now, I know that was a particular tour. There weren't probably as many top-class contenders. He was 8 minutes down at the foot of the Pyrenees. He was 5 minutes down on Jan Ullrich. And obviously went on to win that Tour de France. And that was a Tour de France where one of the big Alpine stages was really became null and void because of a rider protest. So a lot fewer opportunities in that tour for a climber to regain time. There are 7 big mountain stages left in this Tour de France. I think Pinot should probably just, you know, put that decision off for a few days, see how he feels. And, you know, he could still soldier through to a top 5 place on general classification, is my view. But I'm not a direct supportee.
Pantani might have taken massive amounts of EPO as well.
Yeah, but so did everyone else, no?
True.
That's all right then.
Wow. Oh, it's, you know, nonsense.
No, I know what you're saying, Daniel. You're right, but he is the sort of rider whose head does fall off, doesn't it?
Yeah, and
not literally.
No, and I think we might have even mentioned that in the podcast. I mean, that was my sort of fear for him before the Tour de France, and he needs to remedy that, doesn't he? I mean, that is an issue that he's going to have throughout his career. Otherwise, you know, we've seen riders, general classification contenders like this before, who have tended to alternate very good and very bad years, and they're the kind of riders who, when the wind's in their sails, everything's fine, but as soon as the slightest thing goes wrong, then they disconnect mentally. I mean, Bradley Wiggins was like that to a certain extent. You know, he was very much like that in the 2010 Tour de France, wasn't he?
And the 2013 Giro.
Well, exactly.
A similar scenario when he had a bad first week and never recovered from it mentally.
Exactly, and that is a string that Pinot needs to add to his bow, certainly.
Whereas the big four, you certainly can't say that of any of them, can you? Quintana, Froome, Contador, Nibali, these guys are all very robust mentally, very steely, very unlikely, I would think, to crack.
And in terms of steps forward in Pinot's career, okay, you know, winning a mountain stage in the final week or whatever would be great, but the pressure would be off then because he would be out of general classification. Is that really a great leap forward in terms of his development? I would argue that it's not, but what would be a major step forward for him would be, you know, showing that resilience, showing that toughness and overcoming this adversity, not like the 2013 tour, where again his head fell off there and he abandoned, he got ill shortly afterwards, but you know, really toughing it out in this Tour de France.
Any news on William Bonnet? Because he was the first man down yesterday. There was reports that he'd broken his neck. How is he?
He has a fracture in a vertebrae or two, I think, but he's going to be okay.
I mean, yeah, he looked pretty badly beaten up when there were, you know, not surprisingly. Lionel, anything more to add today?
Well, just looking at the GC and how it's shaping up, you know, the GC riders will consider that this is the first most dangerous part of the tour. Negotiated, the next phase isn't without danger. It's probably less obvious danger, chance of crosswinds. But there are now, for the GC riders, more in the way of opportunities than there are in the way of obstacles, if you see what I mean. Like the Mur de Bretagne is a chance for the GC riders to come to the front, and then it's team time trial, which will be significant, and then the Pyrenees. So looking at riders who've done it, will be very happy with the first week. Chris Froome, TJ Van Garderen in third, and Rigoberto Urán, who, you know, he's very quietly turned himself into a, you know, an outside, from an outsider into somebody who's very much in sort of category B already.
And Van Garderen, I mean, we haven't talked about him much. We'll try and get word with him at some point. But he, as you said the other day, I think somebody said, he has not put a foot wrong. He's ridden the perfect race.
He's riding like a luxury Zubeldia, isn't he? Kind of like a Waitrose Zubeldia.
That's Whole Foods, even Whole Foods.
Well, that's a reference that'll be lost on our American listeners. Well, any listeners, indeed, outside the UK, but still.
Yeah, no, he's that's exactly how he's riding. Absolutely.
So tonight your homework is to Google grandmother's footsteps and Waitrose.
Yeah. Well, let's keep an eye on TJ Van Garderen. I'm sure we'll talk about him a bit more when we do our first Velo News podcast with Kayleigh Fritz and Andy Hood, which will be coming up quite soon. We'll be doing a few of those throughout the tour on days that we don't do the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, rest days, and then at the end of the tour we'll squeeze in a couple of Velo News podcast as well, also supported by Jaguar. A few thank yous. We want to say a big thank you to our producers and editors, because they've taken on an extra burden this year of producing our daily morning show, the Kilometre Zero, that goes out Monday to Friday around about 10 a.m. British time. Thanks very much for the reaction to that so far. It will be evolving and developing, but it's, as Lionel said earlier, a different look at the tour, an attempt to sort of take you inside the tour, and we'll be doing features on Daniel's doing crashes, I'm doing a little feature on Eritreans who are riding, that's all coming up. But big thank you to our producers and editors, John Mooney, Paul Scoynes, Jonathan Rowe, Alex Adey and James Wickham. Big thanks especially to Jonathan Rowe, who is involved in lots of other things to do with running the cycling podcast. Thanks also to our travelling partner Simon Gill, our photographer extraordinaire, whose pictures we regularly tweet and are always excellent. Thank you to Jaguar, who are sponsoring us. Without Jaguar, we wouldn't be here covering the race, so thank you to them. We should also point you in the direction of the live blog on the Telegraph, which is done every day by John McCleary. Really knows his stuff. It's funny, it's informative. If you want to follow the race secretly while you're at work, that's probably the best way to do it discreetly. Okay, just another couple of little thank yous and things to do. Finally, become a friend of the Cycling Podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. £5 will gain you access behind our paywall to our special friends podcast. Most recently, we have a Mark Cavendish interview there and our recent event, the Imperfect Tour de France at Foyle's Bookshop. I think that's us for today in Cambrai. We're heading to Amiens now, you and I, Lionel. Daniel, you're going to be at the start tomorrow presenting the Pedalard de Charme t-shirt to Matteo Trentin. That's your job for the morning. Don't mess it up.
You're staying with your wife, aren't you? The wife that you impersonate so beautifully in that guttural Flemish accent.
Yes, thank you. yeah, thanks for that. Yeah, that's exactly who I'm staying with. So is Lionel, but not not in that way. Anyway, let's move on from that and let's finish tonight's podcast. Thanks very much, fellas. See you tomorrow night, Lionel.
Well, see you tonight, but also see you tomorrow night. Yes, Richard, thank you.
You'll see me tonight. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
For the best analysis, discussions and interviews from the 2015 Tour de France, listen to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.